Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And as we begin this week's Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the biz page as usual and we find the article, Noble Spirit. Han remembered with weekend of purpose. The spirit of a Raleigh woman murdered in a shocking knife attack in 2013 lives on when the Jamie Kirk Han Foundation holds its fifth Weekend of Purpose event, October 14. That morning, the foundation will lead guests and businesses in service projects at 18 sites around the Triangle. Then that night, the weekend wraps up with Jamie's Party with a Purpose in Raleigh, as five top chefs, along with local brewers, hold a festive event in Loading Dock, Raleigh. The foundation focuses on three areas: service, finding ways to brainstorm solutions to social problems, and a fellowship program that targets emerging leaders in the age range of 21 to 35. The fellowship program helps young leaders transition to a career in the social sector. In particular, the foundation's work on issues involving food insecurity, early childhood education, and poverty in North Carolina. And under the heading of nonprofit comes When Making a Bee is a Good Thing. When Biz turned in report cards back in the day, Mom never said, "Hey, congratulations on making a bee." But in one case, getting a bee is a great grade. Bee Lab, a nonprofit based in Pennsylvania, designates companies that meet standards for social responsibility as bee corporations. Chapel Hill's Participate, which was called VIF International Education until January, has earned the designation for the fifth year. Participate's original concept was to take cultural exchanges you get in higher education and make them available for K through 12. And the company has grown and thrived over 30 years, now employing 70 people full-time and calling 60 school systems in North Carolina clients. But CEO David Young says public school officials can get concerned when dealing with a for-profit company, sometimes thinking the companies are only out to take their dollars from them. The B Corp designation verifies that the company works in the public interest and treats employees well. And in the Food Central article today comes the article, French, German, all good. A French restaurant in Chapel Hill is getting in the spirit of Oktoberfest and bringing the sausage. Dick and Sue Barrows owned restaurants in Pennsylvania for years, but fell in love with Chapel Hill after their daughter was a student there, so they moved south. Goodbye, Pennsylvania winters. And they opened Kitchen in the Midtown Market Shopping Center in 2010. Dick Barrows says the couple loved going to French restaurants in New York City, and that's why they wanted a French concept. Barrows says the restaurant, with 32 seats and 8 spots at the bar, is cozy, not gigantic, it's manageable. The restaurant will celebrate Oktoberfest on October 23rd with local craft beer, sausage made by a friend from Pennsylvania, and, of course, sauerkraut. But Biz wondered, why is a French restaurant holding a German celebration? Well, first of all, it's October. And second, North Carolina is becoming a craft brewing hotbed, Dick Barrow says. We make it a fun event, very informal. You don't have to have reservations. Okay, works for Biz. Anything with sausage on the agenda gets the Biz seal of approval. And under the heading of Rideshare comes the article, Cashing In with Green Bikes. The shared economy is taking to two wheels in the Triangle as a company based in San Mateo, California, brings its Lime Bike to the Triangle. The company launched in February and debuted its first bikes in June at UNC Greensboro. The idea is college students pay 50 cents to ride for half hour, and others pay a dollar. Once you're done, you leave the bike in a visible spot, and others use the Lime Bike app to find it. Sidney McLaurin, general manager for North Carolina at Lime Bike, says the company has 5,500 bikes deployed around the U.S., and the effort is more than just kids' play. Lime Bike has $12 million in venture funding, led by cash from California firm Andreessen Horowitz. McLaurin, a recent graduate of Duke University's Fuquay School of Business, says there are already 800 bikes in Greensboro, and he expects 1,500 at some point. In Raleigh, that number is 300 and will grow. McLaurin says the bikes are mostly deployed around NC State University, but you can easily spot them at other places around town. We really want to be a ubiquitous mobility solution, he says. One problem, some people are putting bikes in trees or even on rooftops. McLaurin says he saw two in the back of a pickup truck. He says the company expects something to happen to roughly 5 to 10% of the bikes. And under the heading of acknowledgement comes the article, Banker Helped Launch Centennial Campus. It wasn't long ago that the Centennial Campus was just a dream of Claude McKinney, the famed dean of the NC State University School of Design. It also needed cash. And a Raleigh banker who played a key role in getting Centennial Campus rolling was honored for his service recently by Governor Roy Cooper with the Order of the Longleaf Pine. Bob Sutherland remembers when McKinney asked him to join his board of trustees and help raise money for the project. Paltry amounts in those days, but I did help him begin the effort with over $100,000 I solicited from a large real estate developer, Sutherland recalls. And closing out today's biz page is the article, Christy Brinkley to Promote MERS Products. Now, MERS is M-E-R-Z. MERS is getting runway ready with a new partnership with supermodel Christy Brinkley. Through a new initiative, Brinkley, age 63, is sharing her use of MERS products, Jomin, and Ultratherapy, to have the lines between her brow treated and skin on her neckline tightened and lifted, respectively. Christy Brinkley shares MERS's vision that adults should feel comfortable and confident in their own skin every day, and regardless of their age, says Bob Radigan, CEO of MERS North America. With Christy's enthusiastic spirit and involvement, we are pleased to work together to help people live better, feel better, and look better. MERS has global sales of about $1 billion, and for North America, that number is around $350 million. MERS NA announced the relocation of its headquarters from Greensboro to Raleigh back in 2014. Now turning to the On Technology and Banking page, comes a couple of articles. The first is under the heading of Bought. Vlasas inks MaxPoint deal and pledges local growth. Vlasas Digital, the San Francisco-based media delivery firm that bought Marshall-based MaxPoint Interactive, is pledging to keep growing its new subsidiary in North Carolina. The deal closed on October the 10th, taking MaxPoint, a publicly traded company for the last 2 years, private. Hours after the closure, Kali Tran, the San Francisco-based president of Vlasas, said he hoped to grow the advertising technology firm, not make cuts. The market perceives digital media and ad tech right now to be struggling, he said. But if you look at the reality of where budgets are going, it's growth in digital media. I believe that there's this gap in perception versus reality, and I am bullish in digital media companies that have products that are proven to work and teams that are proven to innovate. So what I hope we can do here is take advantage of an opportunity, combine and build a much better platform. And under the heading of restructuring comes the article, Could Layoffs Thwart Citrix's Expansion? The headcount gap created by a recent layoff at Citrix creates a big challenge in fulfilling a 400-job expansion in Raleigh. Records from the NC Department of Commerce show more than just those 400 positions would need to be filled in order to secure the $5.7 million in incentives it had approved for Citrix last year. That's because the headcount at 800 in December is now 619, according to a company representative. As it relates to the JDIG, which most of you know is Jobs Development Investment Grant, Raleigh continues to be a strategic location for Citrix, where we see long-term growth, Citrix spokesman Eric Armstrong said in an email. We have proactively discussed our long-term plans for Raleigh with our government partners and will continue to do so. Note that because it's early in the JDIG program, entered into earlier this year, we have not drawn down any benefits under the program. The December expansion announcement had been celebrated by then-site lead lease Jesse Lipson as a sign of Citrix's commitment to Raleigh. Lipson, the serial entrepreneur who founded and then sold Raleigh's share file, no longer has any direct connection to his former employer. When Citrix bought ShareFile in 2011, Lipson urged his new employer to expand in Raleigh, and expand it did, swelling well past the 85 employees ShareFile had when the buy was announced, and into its own standalone campus in downtown Raleigh's warehouse district. In December, the company picked Raleigh for the 400-job expansion. As its first reporting deadline to the state is in March, no performance data is available, and no funds have been doled out, Commerce spokesman David Rhodes says. Citrix was also approved for a separate JDIG in 2012 when it announced plans to bring 337 jobs to the Triangle. Now we move to the technology page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. Under the heading of the Amazon Ripple, tech execs are hopeful when it comes to Amazon HQ2. They say that, should the Triangle lure the 50,000-job project, it means a reputation boost that, in the end, benefits everybody. Brendan Morrissey, CEO of NetCertive, says he doesn't mind more competition for talent and says an Amazon investment would have huge benefits. At the same time, there are potentially far-reaching consequences that can be hard to discern on the front end. For example, I'm all for certain incentives. Just need to be careful that they play out in the long run and are structured correctly up front, he says. Jeff Pfeiffer, site lead for legal software firm LexisNexis's Raleigh operation, predicts many of the same reasons LexisNexis picked the Triangle for an expansion will attract the interest of Amazon, the talent, infrastructure, and universities. Our view is that it's good for the region, as it would continue to drive Raleigh as a prominent technology hub for development in the United States. And under the heading of expanding comes the article, with buy comes 300 new clients. Marshall-based communications and compliance firm issuer Direct Corporation is acquiring a 56-year-old Salt Lake City company, a move that instantly expands its customer base by more than 300 clients. That firm, Interwest Transfer Company, specializes in stock register and transfer agency services. In acquiring ITC, Issuer Direct bolsters its own transfer agent business, a unit where it has found customer retentions to be the longest. The purchase price, according to a securities filing, consisted of about $1.9 million in cash, more than 25,000 shares of common stock paid at closing, and $960,000 to be paid equally in cash over 3 years. While five of its six employees are being retained in Salt Lake City, Issuer Direct CEO Brian Balbirnie says further build-out of the unit will happen in the Triangle. We'll probably add additional headcount here. I just don't know how much at this point, he says. The local Issuer Direct team that handles stock transfers will stay in place as well. But even without the buy, Issuer Direct is growing. Without Interwest, the team was already up to 64 employees. Balbirnie says there are 11 open positions. Now moving on to the On Life Sciences page of this week's TBJ comes the article, Biomérieux Ready to Ramp Up Bottle Production. French life sciences company Biomérieux unveiled its $60 million expansion in Durham earlier this year. Now that expansion is ready for business. The expansion is for a new production line that will manufacture Biomérieux's BACT Alert blood culture bottles, a critical component of the company's fight against antibiotic resistance. It involved hiring 100 new employees and landing economic development grants of $400,000 from Durham County and $220,000 from One NC Fund, according to Stefan Willemsen, Corporate Vice President for the Americas at Biomérieux. And under the heading of Smart Hires comes the article, Aerie Adds to Research Team in Durham. On the heels of a deal that will see it pay $25 million or more to Liquidia Technologies' spin-out Envisia Therapeutics, Aerie Pharmaceuticals is beefing up in Durham. Aerie said October the 9th that it has appointed 11 employees to its research and development team. Through its recent deal with Envisia, Aerie has acquired the rights to use Invisio's print technology and ophthalmology and other areas, as well as the intellectual property rights to Invisio's preclinical product candidate, ENV-1105, for the treatment of diabetic macular edema. The new employees will initially focus on preclinical activities associated with the drug delivery asset acquisition from Invisia Therapeutics, Aerie stated. While Aerie has corporate locations in Irvine, California, and Bedminster, New Jersey, its research and development is based locally. The company recently expanded by 13,385 square feet to a total of 32,586 square feet at the Imperial Center on Emperor Boulevard, according to Longfellow Real Estate Partners. The expansion includes additional lab and office space, but Aerie has remained tight-lipped on exactly how the expanded space will be used. A new drug application for Rupressa, an eye drop product for the treatment of glaucoma, has been accepted by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration with a date for completion of its review set for February 28th. The company also expects to submit its NDA for another eye drop product, Roclatan, in 2018. As of June 30, Aerie had cash and equivalents of $307.9 million. The company stated its cash burn for the first half of 2017 was $48.4 million, with cash burn for the year expected to be between $100 million and $110 million. Aerie declined to comment on its current headcount in Durham. Now turning to today's Pharma page comes an article about a lawsuit. NC judge dismisses class action against Transenterix. As Research Triangle Park-based Transenterix sits just within reach of U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval for its Senhance surgical robot, a federal securities class action lawsuit filed against the company has been dismissed. The class action was filed in June of last year after the FDA did not approve its first surgical robot known as Surgibot. Among the allegations, plaintiffs in the case stated Transenterix concealed facts from investors, including communications with the FDA related to its Surgibot submission and the potential negative impacts on the company of not receiving FDA approval for Surgibot. As a result of defendants' false statements and material omissions, Transenterix stock traded at artificially inflated prices during the class period, the complaint stated. But on October the 6th, the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina dismissed the case after a September order by a federal judge that stated the plaintiffs did not allege facts to support their assertions. "We're pleased that the securities class action suit was dismissed," said Todd Pope, president and CEO of Transenterix. "We remain confident in achieving FDA 510K clearance of the Senhance surgical robotic system and continue to focus on transitioning toward U.S. commercialization." And under the heading of acquisition comes the article, "Wake Research Expands Based with West Coast Move." Raleigh-based clinical research site network Wake Research has expanded to the West Coast with its acquisition of San Diego-based Medical Center for Clinical Research, known by the acronym MCCR. And it doesn't plan on stopping there, according to President and CEO Dr. Ella Gratch. The acquisition of MCCR increases the number of sites owned or managed by Wake Research to 13. The firm's origins in the Triangle date back 30 years. In an increasingly competitive clinical research landscape, geographic diversity is crucial, Gratch says. "We started talking to MCCR in 2014, Gratch says, noting the timing of the acquisition was right, after Wake Research had completed its acquisition of Chattanooga, Tennessee-based ClinSearch. "We are continuing our expansion," she says, "with another acquisition candidate currently in sight." But she says Wake Research wants to make acquisitions in a careful manner. Some other Wake Research markets include Atlanta, Houston, and Tucson, Arizona, among others. Company-wide, Wake Research employs roughly 100. Financial terms for the acquisition of MCCR are not being disclosed. And under this short heading of "He Said It" comes the quote by Gary Jackson, who's an attorney at James Scott Farran of Durham, representing the plaintiff and class members in this case. It is simply unjust that DuPont and Chemours have dumped toxic chemicals into the Cape Fear River, knowing it would contaminate downstream water users like the Cape Fear Public Utility Authority and the people of Wilmington. We brought this case to bring justice and seek compensation for the interference with people's property rights and seek a program of monitoring for the health effects these chemicals can cause. Now, under the heading of commercial real estate comes the article, Chatham Park's Commercial Developers Unveil $800 Million Project. It won't be like Raleigh's North Hills or the Prestonwood community in Cary. It will be better and more aligned with the needs of tomorrow, say the developers of an $800 million mixed-use project in Chatham County. Eco Group, a joint venture of John Fugo of Montgomery, Carolina, Incorporated, and Kirk Bradley of Lee Moore Capital Company, is leading the commercial development of one of the largest products in the county's history. Fugo and Bradley have previously worked on retail and office projects in Durham and Chapel Hill. The development is called Mosaic, and the pair of developers note the construction of Phase 1, a 44-acre, $140 million entertainment and lifestyle complex, is scheduled to start in the spring. We're starting off this phase to appeal to a demographic we believe would like to walk everywhere, says Bradley, a prominent Triangle developer who is a primary person in the development of the Governor's Club private residential community near Chapel Hill. With Chatham Park delivering its first homes in the spring of 2019, Mosaic will offer an ideal amenity hub for not only Chatham Park homeowners, but also the entire county. Bradley says Tim Smith and Julian Bubba Rawl, the master developers of Chatham Park, wanted to find a developer, to find a partner, to do the commercial work inside the development. We came to an agreement last year, Bradley says, and things are now falling in place. One piece of the puzzle, an important one, that has not been closed is the financing of the project. Bradley says Eco Group is in talks with debt and equity partners. There's no question we have to do a lot of pre-leasing before we can close on the financing. Chatham Park is situated in the heart of Chatham County, which boasts of one of the highest median incomes in North Carolina. The commercial development's preliminary trade area includes 21,000 residents. Commercial development is expected to be complete by 2025. Phase 2 of the project will encompass 92 acres with a development price tag of $250 million. The plan calls for national tenants, such as grocery stores and large companies, looking to relocate to the Triangle. The final phase, which is 187 acres, includes $400 million in development. Now, this week's cover story is called Amazon's Ripple Effect, and it's a very long series of articles. I won't be able to read all of them, but I'll read as many as possible. And on the first of this special report comes the article under the heading of Technology. Wake County Commission Chair on Amazon HQ2. We know we're going to win. As metros across the United States scramble to meet Amazon's October the 19th deadline, the Triangle is working up to its own creative approach to luring the commerce giant's attention and its 50,000 jobs. Wake County Commission Chair Sig Hutchinson confirms that Wake County's RFP for the project is on track. And while absent gimmicks comparable to towns willing to change their name for the project, it's not just a Word document listing attributes. The county has developed a presentation that's designed to have the look and feel of an Amazon review, he says. Similarly to how Amazon shows products on its website, it will have stars showing off Wake County's assets, 5 stars for education and 5 stars for site locations, for example. But it may take more than creativity. Nathan Jensen, a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, who researches incentives, notes New Jersey has reportedly come up with incentive offers as high as $4 billion. He says that in terms of value to a community, Amazon's HQ2 is worth a lot more than Foxconn's proposed investment in Wisconsin. The very, very short RFP deadline complicates the process, however. Numerous long-shot locations will put together big packages, but this is more for show than anything, he says. My research shows that elected officials can deflect blame for not getting an Amazon by putting a big offer on the table. So going all in as an elected official, even if you're positive you're going to lose, is a smart political strategy. Jensen does, however, think North Carolina has a real shot and says incentives, while likely involved, won't be the deciding factor for Amazon. What communities have to remember is that factors that make a location attractive in the long run are the human capital and infrastructure that allows businesses to thrive, he says. Locations have to be careful to not give away so much tax revenue that they are harming their ability to allow local business, as well as new establishments, to thrive. Now comes the lead article from this special report on Amazon, and it's entitled, Amazon's Ripple Effect. Local retailers, resellers build their business models around Amazon's product and its potent reach. Nearly 3,000 miles from home turf in Seattle, Amazon is making its presence known in eastern North Carolina, and not just through the state's effort to recruit its 50,000 job HQ2. From the warehouses supporting its Prime Now offering off Atlantic Avenue in Raleigh, to the massive turbines spinning at the Amazon Wind Farm near Elizabeth City, the state's first utility-scale wind project, Amazon is a visible reminder to the region that change is coming. Across the nation, the firm is putting pressure on brick-and-mortar businesses, a reality further heightened by its recent acquisition of Whole Foods, a move e-commerce entrepreneur and Channel Advisors chairman Scott Wingo calls disruptive to everyone in that space. But for dozens of companies, big and small, across the region, the wave created by the e-commerce giant is one of opportunity, and they're ready to ride. Ed Mitchell has been called a living legacy when it comes to a North Carolina staple, barbecue. The pitmaster, who once won a ribs throwdown against celebrity chef Bobby Flay, has a slew of past restaurant projects in the Triangle under his belt, from the Pit to the now-closed Q restaurant. But his next project isn't a barbecue joint. We're going to be shipping our products nationally, says his son Ryan Mitchell. The inspiration? Seattle e-retailer Amazon, which he says is changing the game. They're attacking the food and beverage game the way they do retail, he notes. The Mitchells have signed a deal with on-demand gourmet food shipper Goldbelly, one of dozens of firms capitalizing on the trend Amazon is owning. And the Mitchells are not alone. Under the heading Pushing Local Products, e-commerce has created opportunities for consumer-oriented entrepreneurs across the Triangle, such as Tatiana Bergeson, whose canned Matt Energy beverages are being shipped via Amazon's platform. And with the addition of Whole Foods, whose shelves already house Triangle homegrown products such as Slingshot Coffee and Nolino Sauce, there could be even more opportunities. Take food traceability firm Food LogiQ, which contracts with Whole Foods to track produce. CEO Dean Wiltz says the Durham company's supply management software can track beef from the farm to the retailer's cooler. Every supplier for Whole Foods today for bulk eggs, cheese, meat, they're required to log in to Food LogiQ and provide the necessary information, he explains. Wiltz says the plan is to leverage its existing relationship with the grocer into a bigger opportunity with Amazon. They really like our product, he says of Amazon. We can help them. Adopting us more broadly actually helps reduce the cost. Wingo says food, however, is just one of the industries Amazon is influencing in the Triangle. He notes that almost every entrepreneur he knows has founded startups with Amazon Web Services platform. And Doug Kaufman, CEO of Transloc, says Amazon's story resonates with the startup community. Amazon is incredibly entrepreneurial, he says. They're a really great model for what you can do when you have a really strong mission. You have a strong core thesis. Everything revolves around the consumer. If they come to our area and you combine that with the tech explosion that's going on, I think it would really lift everybody. But Amazon has competition when it comes to entrepreneurial reach in the Triangle. Google has inked a partnership with co-working outfit American Underground, one that offers discounts and benefits for startups using its own cloud services. And some, including Rhett Crocker, founder of Udo, switched to Google as a result. For the first year we were commercially operating, our server costs were non-existent, he says, pointing to the Google partnership. We only started actually paying for servers in January. While he says Amazon is ahead of the game when compared to Google, IBM, and Microsoft, the products he's using now are 99% as good as Amazon. Multiple major technology firms, too, leverage Amazon partnerships, from Cisco to NetApp to Raleigh-based Red Hat, which recently extended a strategic alliance with Amazon Web Services to further integrate its OpenShift technology. On a recent earnings call, Channel Advisor CEO David Spitz outlined the importance of Amazon to his firm's bottom line. The Marshall-based firm creates software products that help e-sellers use e-commerce platforms, initially driven by eBay. Over the years, the firm has shifted to depend more on Amazon as its biggest supported platform. Spitz said he's finding major brands all recognize that working with Amazon is inevitable and are seeing a holistic Amazon strategy. Major companies such as Nike are relocating their ad spend budget toward Amazon, and in some cases aggressively, he said on the call. They need help with fulfillment, as the on-demand nature of e-commerce forces everyone to evolve from shipping pallets by the truckload to shipping individual orders to consumers. And I'm thrilled because Channel Advisor is the only platform on the market that can address those needs globally, he said to analysts. But in light of the buzz surrounding the state's efforts to recruit Amazon's 50,000 employee HQ2, not everyone is excited about Amazon. Art Pope, chairman of Raleigh-based Variety Wholesalers, the parent of Roses, says North Carolina families and businesses who have been paying taxes in North Carolina for decades should not have to subsidize the relocation of a major company, especially if they're going to compete with them. He says bargain brands like his are protected from the Amazon effect and could really care less about how it's impacting the space from a competitive standpoint. We still have customers who want to look, touch, and feel and shop when they need items, when they need to buy for their family, Pope says. At this point in time, we don't see the need for e-commerce, nor do we see the need to go into the e-commerce competition with Walmart and Amazon and others. That's consistent with what Wingo is seeing. After the recession, people did one of two things. They searched for value, which is why variety is thriving. Then there's the other half. It made me realize I work too hard, and I want to spend more time with my kids, he explains, calling that the convenience-oriented approach. And it's why Prime Now has been so effective. The convenience factor inspired Wingo to co-found Get Spiffy, an on-demand car wash service. And that factor is powering many startups across the globe, from Uber to Shipt. If a company isn't value or convenience-oriented in 2017, you're pretty much toast right now, he says. Now, this report is replete with all sorts of graphs, so I'm going to try to interpret some of those for you because I think they sort of give you more information about Amazon's effect. This first graph is called the Property Report, and it has a big map here, but it also talks about the total occupied square footage of retail and industrial properties in the triangle over the past decade. Now, all these graphs have two reference points, June of 2006 and June of 2017. So in retail, in 2006, 51 million. In 2017, 63.3 million for a 24.1% increase. In industrial, 45 million versus 50 million, that's an 11.1% increase. Now, what about average rents? So the triangle's average retail rent growth has slowed in recent years, while the industrial rates have surged. So in 2006, the retail rent was about $17.49 per square foot. And 2017, $18.94 for an 8.29% increase. How about industrial rents? In 2006, $5.58 per square foot. And in 2017, $6.11. That's a 9.5% increase. How about changes in headcount? Employment in Raleigh's retail sector has rebounded since the depths of the recent recession, but it still lags the highs reached in 2006 and 7. Conversely, warehouse jobs have increased by nearly 10,000 positions. So here we have three graphs talking about retail jobs in Raleigh, retail jobs in Durham, and Amazon total jobs. Once again, the reference points, 2006 and 2017. So retail jobs in Raleigh, up 24.9% from 55,597 to 69,444. And that's during a national change of 11%. How about retail jobs in Durham? Well, there's a 5.82% increase since 2006 from 23,326 to 24,683. And that compares with an 11% national change. The Amazon total jobs, well, there's 2,748% change since 2006. So in 2006, there was 13,900. In 2017, 382,000, which means there's a 4.2% U.S. workforce change in that same period. So you can see that they're really growing fast. There are also a couple of little blurblets here on primary areas in North Carolina competing for HQ2. So just a couple of blurbs about them. First, on Charlotte, A.D. Tomer, a fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program of the Brookings Institution, says, Charlotte has a ton going for it that could be a benefit to land Amazon's HQ2. Charlotte Douglas International Airport is one of the key assets here that would be attractive to Amazon. The Charlotte Chamber and the Charlotte Regional Partnership are joining forces to submit a plan to bring HQ2 to the Charlotte region. Obviously, the Triad area, Greensboro. The Triad has long bragged about having the right ingredients to lure the headquarters of a major company: a strong transportation infrastructure, a trained workforce, and a network of colleges and universities that provide access to thousands of potential talented employees. But Amazon's demands for HQ2 might be too much for the Greensboro-Winston-Salem region to handle. And then the description of Raleigh-Durham. Surrounded by world-class universities and a strong tech community, the Raleigh-Durham area might be a strong sell for Amazon's HQ2, but it has a relatively small labor market. It will really depend on the aggressiveness to which Amazon would approach the recruiting dynamic, says John Boyd, a site consultant at New Jersey-based The Boyd Company. Raleigh is among the top cities that fits Amazon's criteria, according to many reports. So here's a synopsis about the Amazon Effect project. For the past 9 months, the business journals and its 40 newsrooms have made a concerted effort to document the systematic expansion of Amazon.com, Inc., from Class A office spaces in the nation's largest cities to former cornfields and barren industrial spaces long abandoned by industries of old. The company's growth, while massive in scope, has hinged on negotiations with local officials, deals with local real estate developers, and tax breaks blessed by local municipalities. In short, it's all local. This project is both near-term and forward-looking in scope and sets off to identify where the Seattle-based company's unrelenting expansion might be headed. It's as much about Amazon's endgame as a business entity as it is about the long-lasting effect it's likely to have on America for decades to come. As I mentioned, this is a very lengthy article, and we'll continue this in next week's Triangle Business Journal. Now moving on to the Triangle Business Journal and other sections, comes the executive voice section for this week's TBJ, and the interviewee this week is Mike Reed. The startup called Skia began upstairs, above a T-shirt shop 11 years ago on Chapel Hill's Franklin Street and across from a movie theater. It was three other people and me, founder Mike Reed says. Fast forward to today, and the company's back on Franklin Street, though under the Google umbrella. It has about 40 employees in a brick building bearing the Google logo across from the new Target. Reed's always been fascinated with computers. He was an undergraduate at Northwestern University when the first Mac came out, and he thought it was the most stellar thing he had ever seen. So he pivoted his students from biology and math to computers, eventually landing a job at Apple. Silicon Valley was everything he thought it would be, he says. It was innovative. It was competitive. He remembers sleeping at Apple, working at Apple. For me, that was a fine lifestyle, he recalls. But it wasn't the place to raise a family, so he moved back to North Carolina to create Skia, a company specializing in licensing graphics software. Reed, originally from Nebraska, spent his high school years in Charlotte. It was easy to recruit, he recalls. I just had to cross the street and go to the computer science department. The Silicon Valley connections he had made while working at Apple would become critical to Skia's journey. While visiting California, Reed connected with an old Apple colleague, now at a new company. He shared a demo, and the two talked about opportunities with open-source phone technology, the basis for what would one day be Android. The pair exchanged some emails, and then there was silence. I didn't hear from him, he recalls. Then he wrote back to me with, "Actually, I have a new email address." He had been acquired by Google. And he was interested in the graphic software Reed and his Chapel Hill team were developing. So, under the cover of darkness, Google acquired Skia for an undisclosed sum. Initially, Google wanted Reed to move the team to Silicon Valley. "We dug our heels in," Reed says. Google acquiesced, letting the engineers stay in Chapel Hill and staff up. "We needed extra heads to actually realize the value that Google wanted to create," he says. When the deal closed, no announcements were made. "It was a secret project," Reed adds, noting that for about 3 years, few knew about Google's Chapel Hill team. But while they remained in that office initially, life was soon different. "Google kept giving us equipment," he says. It was so much that the team moved to Southern Village before returning to Franklin Street last year. Through it all, they kept their heads down, working. "The bulk of the people here still do the same technology," Reed says. "We developed a graphics engine. It's still the engine used by Android on your phone. It's also on Google Chrome." "It's great to be back close to campus," he says. "We have people in the office who did classes at UNC. A lot of us go to periodic talks at events." The Google logo, now plastered on the side of the new building, is a big step forward for such a formerly secretive team, Reed says. Now there's a pending list of people who want to transfer to Chapel Hill from other Google outposts, he says. Reed hopes Google considers a triangle for future investment, noting the talent at the three universities. "Even colleges other than UNC produce smart graduates," he adds. "Google has room to grow at its new Chapel Hill digs," he says. "The current space could accommodate up to 15 additional engineers, and there's additional space available." Reed says collaboration is the triangle's biggest entrepreneurial asset. "I found that finding partners, from people to other small companies to collaborate with, was just as valuable as finding direct customers," he says. Now we turn the page to the small business section of this week's Triangle Business Journal. Under the heading of personal growth comes an article written by Harvey McKay. McKay is a syndicated columnist, the author of Swim with the Sharks Without Being Eaten Alive. And the article is Six Key Traits That Are the Hallmark of Top Performers. Are you performing up to your potential? Are you afraid to jump to the next level? Are your habits pushing you forward or holding you back? The most important book on self-motivation and achieving more than you imagined hit the bookstores recently, High Performance Habits, How Extraordinary People Become That Way, by Brendan Burchard. Burchard's a world-leading high-performance coach, drawing inspiration from Stephen Covey's The 7 Habits of Highly Successful People, which he describes as the best book of all time. I've heard Burchard speak on several occasions, so I invited him to speak to my roundtable group about his results. The right habits lead to sustained long-term success. High performance means succeeding beyond standard norms, consistently over the long term, he said. It feels like full engagement, joy, and confidence that come from giving your absolute best. Shockingly, fewer than 15% of the population are high performers, Burchard says. Years of research led him to identify the six deliberate habits that give people the edge. He also discovered that anyone can practice these habits with extraordinary results. High performance is not strongly correlated with age, gender, nationality, intelligence, personality, strengths, creativity, empathy, years of experience, or compensation, Burchard said. Instead, he cites these six habits and a long-term success story. 1. Seek clarity. Compared with their peers, high performers have more clarity on who they are, what they want, how to get it, and what they find meaningful and fulfilling, Burchard said. You generate clarity by asking questions, researching, trying new things, sorting through life's opportunities, and sniffing out what's right for you. It comes from asking yourself questions and further refining your perspective on life. 2. Generate energy. He said, I found that most effective way to help high performers increase their energy is to teach them to master transitions, which he calls a space of freedom between activities. I'm convinced that if we can get you to change the way you shift from one activity to the next, we can revitalize your life, Burchard said. 3. Raise necessity. Necessity is the emotional drive that makes great performance a must instead of a preference, he said. When you feel necessity, you don't sit around wishing or hoping. You get things done. He continued, if I've learned anything from my research and a decade of interventions developing high performers, it's that you cannot become extraordinary without a sense that it's absolutely necessary to excel. 4. Increase productivity. The fundamentals of becoming more productive are setting goals and maintaining energy and focus, Burchard said. Clear and challenging goals are the starting point. Taking care of yourself, including good sleep, nutrition, exercise, and positive emotions, help you maintain energy. Keeping focused isn't easy in the modern era, with information overload and distractions, and interruptions diminish productivity. 5. Develop influence. Having influence means you get people to believe in you or your ideas, buy from you, follow you, or take actions that you request of them, he said. Of course, influence is a two-way street. And finally, 6, demonstrate courage. Our coaching intervention suggests that demonstrating courage is the cornerstone habit of high performance, Burchard said. Demonstrating courage doesn't mean you have to save the world or do something grandiose. Sometimes it means taking a first step toward real change in an unpredictable world. Burchard offers specific examples that illustrate how to develop these habits, as well as exercises and practices for achieving high performance status. Get ready to up your game. Now, under the heading of family business comes the article, Form a Plan and Then Act Decisively. This is written by James Lee, who is a family business speaker, author, and advisor. In the past 6 months, Chuck has called me 5 times and sent me more than a dozen emails. It seems that he picked up on a column I wrote last summer and has been trying ever since to put some new ideas to work in his family's business. Look, Chuck, I told him in August, it's always a pleasure talking with you, but you're going to have to do more than chat on the phone if you want to straighten out your problems. Yeah, he answered, I know, but what do you think? Am I moving in the right direction? Right direction? You're not moving in any direction, Chuck. We've exchanged a lot of words across the wire since last July, but you're not one step closer to making changes. Let's go over it one more time, he said. Then I'll swing into action right after the first of the year, okay? Okay. My son Todd's been working in the business for the past 7 or 8 years, and he's ready to take over the top job just as soon as I retire. But after my daughter's marriage went on the rocks, she wanted to come back home from California and go to work in the family business, too. She's a crackerjack with marketing. Clear? Yes, Chuck, that's the way you've explained it to me several times. Okay, so my wife is really pushing me to let Caroline, that's my daughter, come into the business as a full partner with Todd, that's my son. I know Todd's your son, I sighed. And Todd resents having Caroline come in as an equal partner because she's been doing other things while he's been earning his spurs in the business by the sweat of his brow. Right, Chuck said. Todd says he's entitled to majority ownership of the company and the president's job, too, as a reward for all his hard work. Caroline says she's entitled to half the stock and a co-presidency because she's my kid, too. And your wife? and my wife is ready to use her 10% share of the business to keep things up in the air unless I do things her way. So I guess my problem is, you know what your problem is, Chuck? You've got to give your family a plan for ownership and management succession that makes the best use of each child's strength, while focusing on the best long-term interests of the business. I'll be happy to help you iron out that problem, but I think you've had it in your head for months. There was a silence before Chuck asked, "So how come I still have the problem?" "Because the plan is still a dream. You haven't put anything together in detail, tested it with expert advisors, and then stood up in front of the family and announced it," I said. "Chuck, you're the senior owner of your business and the head of your family. Leadership demands decisiveness." "I wish this whole thing would just work itself out," he said morosely. "Maybe the kids can come up with a plan by themselves." "Things almost never just work themselves out, Chuck," I said. "You've got to take responsibility for putting the future of your business together and then putting it in motion. If planning is the key to family business succession success, then indecisiveness is the key to its failure." Now moving to the viewpoint page for this week, in the editor's notebook comes, "In our HQ2 pitch, perhaps we should reimagine things." It's crunch time for communities making their pitch to land America's second corporate headquarters, to land Amazon's second corporate headquarters, which comes with 50,000 jobs and about $5 billion in capital investment. I've covered business across many states in this country. I do not remember this kind of economic development frenzy engulfing the imagination of people engaged in recruiting companies and jobs. As you read through the pages of our special Amazon report this week, you will notice just how intense the competition is, and perhaps more importantly, how critical it is for communities to make sure the RFP addresses much more than the minimal requirement. More than likely, Amazon has made up its mind about the communities that have made the final cut. It could be 5, 10, or even 15 cities. So the frantic work done by most communities is really for nothing. As for Raleigh's bid, most people agree that we should be a contender. In the end, it may come down to two issues: mass transit options and available workforce. Several people in the past couple of weeks believe that mass transit issue could be mitigated by showing that locals are in favor of it. And the question really is when, not if, the Triangle will someday have light rail running between Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, Raleigh-Durham International Airport, and other fast-growing communities. The availability of a skilled workforce to cater to 50,000 positions will also be an issue not only for Raleigh, but for most communities. In a speech to Princeton University's graduating class in 2010, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos said he took a less safe path to follow my passion, and I'm proud of that choice. What he was talking about is his ability to solve a problem with new products or services that did not exist at that time. The fail rate for those choices are disproportionately higher than successes. To recruit Amazon's HQ2, if communities talk only about their perceived strengths relating to quality of life, cheap land, office space, and affordable living strengths, Bezos and his team are unlikely to be impressed. Same goes for states that are willing to throw billions in tax credits for a period of 20, 30, or even 40 years. Amazon sits on about $20 billion in cash and short-term investments at the end of every quarter. They like free money, but it's unlikely to make or break. Our pitch desperately needs that sauce. We may not get HQ2, but thanks to Bezos, we are already ahead of the curve. The guest opinion this week is written by Glenn Rikers, who serves as vice chairman of Vienna, Virginia-based EverFi, senior advisor at Valhalla Partners. Immigration is important for America's future to drive workforce growth, innovation, and entrepreneurship. As someone who's been at the intersection of innovation and venture capital for many years, I'm alarmed by current trends in immigration policy and attitudes. While it may be politically expedient to demonize immigrants, let's use the facts to inform the solutions. First, simple demographics show that we need more immigrants, not fewer. Our native-born workforce is actually shrinking as baby boomers retire. We will need immigrant workers filling jobs and paying income and Social Security taxes to help pay for a larger retiree base. The alternatives are either much higher taxes or a reduction in benefits paid to retirees. Secondly, as an investor, I can tell you that immigrants are an important driver of our innovation economy. In a recent study by the National Foundation for American Policy, of the 90 private companies with valuations of more than $1 billion, More than half were founded by immigrants. These immigrants created companies that employ, on average, 760 people in the U.S. Next, various studies show that automation through technology causes 80% plus of job displacement, rather than immigration or other sources of lower-cost labor here or abroad. Technology has been displacing labor in some form for more than 200 years. Now, as robotics and machine learning continue to improve, we must adapt education, training, entrepreneurship, and global trade practices to support the creation of high-value jobs. This is not an issue of immigration, but rather the acceleration of change in the world economy. Lastly, legal and illegal immigrants have lower levels of criminal activity than the overall population, according to several studies aggregated by the Cato Institute. Yes, there are specific terrible stories about immigrants and immigrant gangs, but these stories sadly exist about Americans born here, too. Why does this all matter? It's critically important that we understand the truth, not the myths, about immigrants and their role in our society. For years, our nation has welcomed immigration. Yes, there have been cycles where nativism pushed back against immigration, but each time this occurred, we eventually embraced and included those who were stigmatized. And each time, our national wealth increased, as did opportunities for all. We need thoughtful, fact-driven immigration laws. If we want to grow our economy, it comes apparent to be pro-business in the 21st century is to make investments in the people that are here while we support rational and fact-based immigration policies. Demonizing immigrants to gain political points is not a strategy for success. The path to economic growth is for our political leaders to understand the facts and be willing to engage citizens on both emotional and factual levels. Only then can leaders help everyone understand what's best for the country and for themselves. I fear that the required leadership is lacking. Leading people against a common but false enemy has been tried for centuries as a weak substitute for the hard work of enabling everyone to have an opportunity to be great. We're better than that. Let's do the hard work. And let's support candidates for office who share this vision of a dynamic, growing America and are ready to help make it happen. Well, that music means that we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Once again, that's 919-832-5138.